We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the lunchtime campus Bible study, where it was delivered for university students.
Within our culture, religion is basically for wimps and women, which is not exactly the same thing. Real men follow beer and football. Christianity is despised, rejected, ridiculed, and by and large ignored by real men, because Christianity, as with all religions, so weak, so wet. The weakness is seen in that it is weak both in brain and in brawn. Weak in brain because Christianity is so intellectually weak, a silly superstition, irrational, and unable to prove its point. In fact, disproved by science. Weak in brawn because there is no change to life or society or the world as a result of Christianity. Evil still rules, even if not especially in the church. People are still greedy, people are still materialistic. Christians are full of hypocrisy and humbug. Acts chapter 12 illustrates all this with three events. First, there is the apostolic death, then there is the apostolic deliverance, and then there is the death of Herod, each of which is demonstrating the weakness of Christianity in brain and brawn. First, there's the apostolic death. In verse 2, Herod killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. James was the son of Zebedee, the brother of John, the partner of Peter in the fishing industry, and he was killed by King Herod Agrippa I. One of the tricks you need to know in Bible reading is that there are seven Herods referred to in the New Testament. It was King Herod who killed the little babies at the time of Jesus. That was Herod the Great. There was King Herod who had to deal with Jesus. That was the next generation. This is King Herod the First, Agrippa the First, which is the third generation of the Herod family. This execution of James was popular, and so led to even more imprisonments. And when Herod saw, verse 3, that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. It's worth a momentary obituary for the Apostle James. Growing up in Galilee as a fisherman, he followed maybe John the Baptist and certainly Jesus. He was one of the inner three of the 12 disciples who were the inner group of the crowds that followed Jesus. He was with Peter and John at the transfiguration of Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. He was with Peter and John as those who went really close to Jesus and stayed with him on the night he was killed, night he was betrayed rather, when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane after the Passover feast. He was one of the two brothers, James and John, one of the two brothers called the Sons of Thunder, because amongst other things they desired to wipe out a Samaritan village that wouldn't accept Jesus. He was one of the two brothers who made the request of Jesus, "Could we sit at your right hand and your left hand in power when you come in your kingly glory?" And he was promised by Jesus not that he could sit there, but that he would be suffering. James was one of those men who understood and desired the power and force of government, to sit at the right hand in all power and authority, to wipe out the village that rejected us. But James was not given the position of power and government. He himself was wiped out by persecution under King Herod. Governments always oppose the truth and oppose righteousness. They never serve people, but they always rule over people with power. They marginalise those who stand for truth and ultimately persecute those whom they marginalised, and they domesticate those who are willing to compromise. Anyone who is happy to compromise with the truth is useful to a government. Anybody who is unhappy to compromise with truth will be called a fanatic, a fundamentalist, a terrorist, and will lose their civic rights. That's how governments operate. The government of Australia is no different to others. It basically ignores Christians because Christians are either religious fanatics and therefore are marginalised and you don't have to pay any attention to them, or they vote according to party, not principle, and therefore you can domesticate them to your cause. Once Christians become a vocal force within a community, then the government will take them seriously and take action against them. And you'll see at all levels of government. You can see it in schools, you can see it in universities, you see it within the family. As long as Christians keep their head down, don't do anything, don't say anything, don't actually invade the intellectual community of the university, they are tolerated and chaplains are appointed. But once we stand up and speak, once we invade the intellectual discussion in tutorials and in prac classes and in the streets and in the cafes, why, then rules are brought in about proselytising and how you're not to do that. It's the same in families, isn't it? A little bit of religion, well, that's all right. We like you to have a little bit of religion, but don't become serious. Serious, of course, being the code word for fanatical, divisive of our family and its traditions and its ways. Just a little bit, that's all you need to inoculate you from getting the real disease. Christians can be ignored because Christianity is profoundly weak. The second event is the apostolic deliverance from jail. Peter, who is caught up in Herod's persecution, is miraculously delivered. This event may illustrate the brawn of Christianity, that the king cannot kill every Christian he wants to, that God can rescue even out of well-guarded prisons, though Peter still winds up in hiding, you'll notice. But it illustrates the brainless, superstitious element of Christianity, the magical fantasy of fairyland, with angels and doors that magically open and gates that swing open without any apparent help and guards who sleep at the right moment and chains that fall off. It all sounds like you're in a magic land, you're in a fantasy and in a fiction. And if God does hear the prayers of Peter, why didn't he hear the prayers of James? What's so special about Peter and what's so special about James that Peter can be rescued and James can be killed? Is Peter more important than James? Did Peter pray more than James? Did Peter pray the right way better than James? Then there is the third element of chapter 12, namely Herod's death. Acts 12 23 reads, immediately because Herod did not give praise to God, an angel of the Lord struck him down and he was eaten by worms and died. The timing was just so perfect. At the moment Herod is being proclaimed as a god, he is struck down and killed. And this is a fantastic sermon illustration of the power, the brawn of God, of reversing the power of Herod. It is a fantastic sermon illustration in the sense of fantastic, isn't it? Fantasy. I mean, that's the real problem, isn't it? I mean, the coincidence is too good to be true. It's too convenient for the Christian cause. To believe that this actually is what happened historically is to believe that Iraq has no weapons and America has no plans, that Hitler wasn't trying to expand his empire and the Holocaust didn't happen, that tobacco companies never lie and smoking's good for your health. There are all kinds of things that people want us to believe, but to believe that at this exact right moment when he's being acknowledged as God, that God would chop him down, well, at best it's a fable, a parable, with the obvious moral against arrogance, but not to be taken as serious history. At worst, it's a total fabrication concocted to persuade the simple-minded and superstitious with a cautionary tale, a fear-mongering warning against ignoring God. And so chapter 12 sees the weakness of Christianity, the lack of brawn to protect the Apostle James, the lack of brain necessary to believe in Peter's deliverance or Herod's death. There's a debate taking place in America at the moment about the miners who were rescued out of Pennsylvania. Lots of prayer went up for them, and 9 of them were rescued. And now people are saying, we've got to remember to thank God for rescuing them. And other people are saying, well, if God could rescue those 9, how come he didn't rescue the 3,000 out of the towers back on the 9th of September, 11th of September? I mean, how come the prayers then weren't answered? What was so wrong with the people in New York that they had to be killed, and so right with the miners in Pennsylvania that they could be rescued? It's the James Peter problem, isn't it? What's so good about Peter that he's rescued, so bad about James that he's killed? But for many of us, of course, we have found that Christianity is neither weak nor stupid. It, in fact, strong. Strong meat intellectually and life-changing in its effect and force upon us. And that the perceptions of the weakness in chapter 12 are really superficial and ignorant prejudice. For rather than this chapter illustrating the weakness of Christianity, this chapter illustrates the true nature of the strength of Christianity. Sure, we see recorded the apostolic death. The apostle was executed and martyred. But that is exactly what Christianity expected. It expects it in general, because when Jesus calls disciples to be his disciples, he says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Taking up the cross was the general expectation for all disciples. Being executed, being martyred, is what Christians assume may well happen to them because they have offered to take up the cross and in their following of Jesus. And specifically we expected it of James because Jesus prophesied it. You see, in that passage where James says, can we sit at the right hand or the left hand of you when you come in your God, in your princely power, Jesus said, you don't know what you're asking. It's Mark 10, 38, 39. You don't know what you're asking. Can you drink the cup I drink of, or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? Both the images of Jesus' death that is coming upon him. James said, we can. Jesus said to them, you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with. So Jesus predicted that James and John would suffer as he suffered. So just in general, all Christians are to expect persecution. James and John specifically were to expect this kind of persecution and death. Christianity, that is not for the weak-hearted. It's not for the cowards. It's not for the wimps who run at the first sign of opposition. Christianity is for those who will live and die for the truth, who will live and die for God, who will live and die for changing the world. If you will not die for something, then you are not living for anything. Do grasp it, friends. If there is nothing in this world that you would lay down your life for, then there is nothing in your life worth living for. It's part of the program. And Christians have died the martyr's death down the centuries in their millions. And the majority of them were killed in the last century. Of course, the population in the last century is so vastly greater. But when we die, we don't die as fanatical suicide bombers. But we die as the recipients of governmental and mob violence. Today, Christians are dying. Christians are being killed in Indonesia, in the Sudan, in Pakistan, in India. Christians are being killed. It continues around the world and down to this time, where communism reigned in China, as it does now, but when it did in Russia, Christians were killed in large numbers. They were killed by the extreme right-wing governments of fascism in Italy and in Germany. They were killed by the extreme left-wing governments of socialism in China and Russia. They're killed in Muslim countries. They're killed. It is the character of where Christians are. A Jewish man became a Christian some 20 or so years ago in Sydney, and he told the secrets of the nuclear arsenal inside Israel that he had personally been working in. He was kidnapped, put in prison, where he still continues to this day. He spent years in solitary confinement, for he told the truth as a result of his conversion to Christ. Christians are still suffering around the world, being persecuted and being oppressed in large numbers, it is the character of what it is to be a Christian. That is, Christianity is not for those comfortable middle-class bureaucrats who make lofty pronouncements about the third world's needs. But Christianity is for the adventurous, committed, self-sacrificing souls who go and live in the deserts and in the jungles and in the mountains, who live in poverty and who live in squalor in order to bring help. Malcolm Muggeridge was a Fabian. He was a socialist, a left-wing journalist. He became the editor of the famous magazine Punch, but for many years he was a journalist for the Manchester Guardian, the left-wing newspaper of Britain. He travelled the world and he said, "I have travelled the world and never saw a humanist hospital or a Fabian primary school." But everywhere he went, he saw Christians setting up schools and hospitals for people in abject poverty and difficulty. And James knew that Jesus had prophesied James's death. At this point, the intellectual cynic amongst us can say, "Yes, well, of course, that was written back in the Gospel afterwards. You know, James has been executed, and so as to make it look like God has not lost control and that everything's up, you write back some event in the Gospel account that predicts it's going to happen." Of course, on this occasion, the problem with that kind of cynical response is that it's recorded for us in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 20, verse 23, and in Mark's Gospel, chapter 10, verse 39, but it is not recorded in Luke's Gospel. And Luke wrote the book of Acts. So if the book of Acts was written by Luke, who was then going to doctor the Gospel account so as to put a prophecy in the mouth of Jesus, he forgot to do it. Christianity does not promise health and wealth, ease and comfort in this world. In fact, it gives it. Christians do live healthier lives, they do live wealthier lives, they are better educated, they raise the environment and the quality of life for everybody around about them, but Christianity doesn't promise that. What Christianity promises is persecution and rejection, division, hostility and death. For Christians are the people who follow the crucified one. And so, we see the very wisdom and strength of Christianity in the fact that its leaders, like James, were executed. It's not a sign of God losing control, it's a sign of the plan being put into effect. It's what was promised, it was what was delivered. What is surprising is not the apostles' death, but the apostolic deliverance. The surprise is not that James was killed, the surprise is that Peter was rescued. And you can see it's a surprise to them. For though the Christians were praying earnestly all night for Peter's deliverance, they didn't expect his release. They didn't believe it when it happened. Look over at verse 15. They said to her, "You're out of your mind." But she kept insisting that it was so. And they kept saying, no, it's his angel. But Peter kept knocking. And when they opened the door, they saw him and were amazed. They're praying for Peter's rescue, they're praying for his release, but they're not really expecting it. And when it happens, you get this fairly humorous event that the girl opens the door, sees through the grill that it's Peter, is so excited that she forgets to let him in, shuts the door and leaves him outside. It's one of those touches of real life. You would have to be a brilliant writer, as a fiction writer, to think up that little episode. But it's the kind of funny thing that happens that you would never forget, and you'd be telling that story for generations, wouldn't you? You can imagine Rhoda in her old age telling her grandchildren and her great-grandchildren about the time she left the Apostle Peter standing at the door while she went in and told everybody that Peter was standing at the door. It's just the kind of character of real-life truth that fiction writers are hard-pressed to ever invent. God in his power and might can do the very things of rescuing Peter, but he rarely does. And this is recorded because it happened, because it was so unusual, because it showed that Herod was not in control after all, because it was Passover time, you'll notice in verse 4, the time when Jesus was crucified, the time when Israel was miraculously rescued out of Egypt, the time when the death of the sacrificial lamb paid for others to be freed. But it does seem strange, doesn't it? angels in chains falling off and doors opening. But to say it seems strange tells you more about you than it does about the truth. Remember Shakespeare in Hamlet, has Hamlet saying, "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt in your philosophy." That's the problem for most of us, that life is stranger than we ever expect. Byron says it in his writings, "'Tis strange but true, for truth is always strange, stranger than fiction." Truth is indeed stranger than fiction. That's one of the characteristics of truth when you read it. Things happen that you would never have thought up happening. That is part of the character of life. Strange just means it doesn't fit in with the normal. Well, a book that just writes about everything that's normal is a pretty boring book to read, isn't it? The last thing you need to read is a book about total normality. That is a very boring book. You might try the phone book. That's fairly normal. It just is not interesting reading. But strange also means that it doesn't fit in with my predetermined understanding of life. See, there's a famous story from the 20th century of a great preacher in India called Sundar Singh. He was persecuted. He was put in an execution well, dropped down there with the bones of the people who had died before him, broke his arm as he went down. He lay down in this well, a cover placed over the top of the well, expecting to die of starvation over the next few days. It was a form of execution, and a fairly unpleasant one. Then one night, the cover was opened and a rope was lowered down. With a loop in the bottom of it, he put his foot in the loop and the man at the top said, "Hang on," and he pulled the man out. And as he clambered over the edge of the well, he untangled himself the rope. He looked around to talk to the man and thank him for... And the man wasn't there. There was no one there. Who was the man who rescued Sundar Singh? We have no idea. He never came forward. He never acknowledged. Was he one of the guards? Was he bribed? Was he... felt sorry for this man? Was he a friend? No idea. But out of the blue, this man came and rescued Sundar Singh, who was preaching in the city the next day, much to the horror of the government authorities, who couldn't work out how he'd ever got out of the well. Well, what about Peter? He said, "But no, Peter, it's here about an angel." But there's one of your problems, friends. What does an angel look like? Have you ever seen one? Would you recognise one if they came? Well, yes, of course, they've got the big wings, haven't they? And a halo hanging over their head, and, you know, that kind of fishing plate that lies at the back of the heads of people in stained glass windows, a big kind of dinner plate that's there. Well, notice verse 15 again. Recognising Peter's voice in her joy, she first walked in. She didn't open the gate, but ran in and reported that Peter was standing at the gate. And they said to her, "You're out of your mind." But she kept insisting that it was so. And they kept saying, "It is his angel." Why would they think it is his angel? Well, because when she saw him, she thought it was Peter. So within their understanding of angels, angels must look like men, mustn't they? And Peter's angel must look like Peter. You see, angels don't necessarily have wings. Angels can look just like us, which is why we're told in Hebrews that people can entertain angels unawares. Because it just looks like a man. It just looks like another person. They don't necessarily wear dressing gowns. Who was it that rescued Peter? Well, we're told it was an angel. It was the hand of God. It was the messenger of God. And that's what Sundar Singh thought too. He was rescued by an angel. It was a messenger of God. For the word angel just means messenger. But was that messenger a supernatural spirit, or was that messenger a human? I have no idea. He's just a messenger of God. And could there be a messenger of God who had bribed the guards, who had a fair of the keys, who was a government authority, who was someone close up and high up in the system of Herod's government, and whose name we didn't want to use, and Peter didn't? Well, that's quite possible, isn't it? That is, there's a completely naturalistic explanation, there are several, as to how Peter got out of prison. But the New Testament is not interested in the naturalistic explanations. The New Testament is interested in the supernatural hand of God. For whatever agency and mechanism God used, be it some kind of spirit power and force doing it magically, or be it a human who comes along and does it quite physically, that is an irrelevance. What Peter and the apostles saw was this was the hand of God. That in a totally hopeless situation, suddenly, inexplicably, I was released. And I take it's the hand of God. Whenever you're sick, pray. And whenever you recover, thank God for it. But whenever you're sick and you're praying, make sure you take your tablets as well. For God uses the forces of this world to bring about his purposes. He can heal you without the tablets. He can heal you with the tablets. The tablets alone will never heal you. That is an illusion. If God wishes you to remain sick, you will remain sick. The healing power of the body lies not in the tablets. That's not where it lies at all. That's one of the problems, you see. We've been heavily influenced by a thing called deism. Deism is the view that God created a natural fixed order of a universe like a machine. And everything is operating in that mechanistic fashion, and God is completely outside of it with nothing to do with it. And so every time God intervenes, he's putting his fingers in the mechanism and destroying the natural order for the miracle to take place. But that is not how the Bible teaches us to understand the world at all. Certainly God has created the universe, but he sustains the universe every inch, every millimetre of the way. It is because of his continued preservation of the universe that the grass grows and that the earth rotates and that your hair falls out and that your hair grows, and every detail of this universe is sustained and maintained by God himself. And so all the actions of this world, they may be regular, they may be orderly, they may be able to be studied and even anticipated and predicted, but all the events and activities of this world happen because of God's continuing sustenance. And he doesn't have to step in and change the natural order in order to bring about his purposes. He can use the natural order. Remember when the children of Israel crossed the Red Sea? Now that sounds miraculous. God puts his hand in the sea and divides it for the children of Israel. But in one of the accounts of the crossing of the Red Sea, you are told that God sent a great wind that drove back the waters of the sea. I can say God by his hand drove back the waters of the sea, or I can say God by the wind drove back the sea. One tells me the ultimate cause of the action, the other tells me the instrument by which the ultimate cause brought about his action. Here Peter is rescued by a messenger of God, an angel whom he doesn't identify and didn't know. Quite amazing, quite surprising, but it's no different to Sundar Singh, who was rescued by an agent he didn't know. Sundar Singh thought it was a man till he got up there and then saw it was an angel, for it was a messenger of God. Peter thought it was an angel till he got outside and then wondered how God had rescued him out there. Interestingly, Peter rescued here, yet you would expect him to be, because he's so important. You see, James is only mentioned once in the book of Acts up till this time, Acts chapter 1 verse 13, and this is the last reference to him. Peter has been mentioned 70 times. Peter is the main character of the book of Acts up till chapter 12. After chapter 12, Peter is only going to be mentioned once more. This is the swan song of Peter. This is the end of Peter, really, in the story. From here on in, the Jewish evangelism by Peter is going to be swallowed up by the Gentile evangelism by Paul. This is kind of the end of the Peter saga, the Peter story. And therefore, the author doesn't need to rescue Peter, because Peter is going to play no further part in the story, really. I mean, he is a little bit in chapter 15, but he's not the leading hero and character anymore, a new man. In fact, this would have been a convenient place to get rid of Peter, if you're writing the story. But no, Peter is rescued to be heard of not again. Furthermore, remember that when Acts is written, the people in the story were still alive. Mark was a young man, and it was his house that Peter went to. And Rhoda was a young woman who was working in that house, known by name. And Mark became a colleague of Barnabas and Paul and Luke, because Luke and Barnabas and Paul and Mark were all in the same missionary group. Peter was well known in Jerusalem. Too many people would remember this for a completely concocted fiction and story. But finally, let me show you your prejudice against the New Testament. For just as we found it hard to believe in Peter's deliverance, we found it hard to believe in the account of Herod's death. It sounded too good to be true, too far-fetched, too convenient. But it's at this point that you can test the New Testament for historical accuracy. You see, Peter and James are minor characters in history. Only Christians are likely to record Peter and James. There are a couple of fishermen who followed a Messiah who was crucified. That one actually happened to be God, who's risen from the dead, and so centuries later people are following him, and therefore we think they're very important. But if you're a secular historian of the first century, Peter, James, they're just followers of Jesus, of Nazareth. They're of no significance. But Herod Agrippa I, now he was important. He was a king. He was a man of power and prominence. He was the grandson of King Herod the Great, and he was the second greatest ruler in the Herodian family. He ruled the empire, pretty much the empire that his grandfather Herod ruled. He was really significant. And therefore, it's not surprising to find King Herod Agrippa I recorded in non-Christian history. Josephus, the Jewish historian of the first century, writes about King Herod Agrippa I. Because you can't tell a story of the history of the Jews and leave out a king of such enormous importance and prominence. And so the death of King Herod is recorded for us in Josephus. Let me read it for you. Whoops, give you the first page first to be helpful. Got water up here, so I've stuck bits on. I'm sorry about that. On the second day of the great feast, Agrippa put on a robe made of silver throughout, of altogether wonderful weaving, and entered the theatre at the break of day. Then the silver shone and glittered wonderfully as the sun's first rays fell on it, and its resplendence inspired a sort of fear and trembling in those who gazed on it. Immediately his flatterers called out from various directions, using language that boded him no good, for they addressed him as a god, and invoked him with the cry, "Be gracious unto us. Hitherto we have acknowledged thee as a man, but from henceforth we acknowledge thee to be of more..." "We acknowledge thee to be of more than mortal nature." He didn't rebuke them, nor did he repudiate their impious flattery, but soon afterwards he looked up and saw an owl sitting on a rope above his head, and immediately recognized it as a messenger, the Greek word there is angel, of evil, as it had been on a former occasion been a messenger of food. Sorry, that must be good. And a pang of grief pierced his heart. The trouble with spell checks, isn't it? Pierced his heart. At the same time, he was seized by a severe pain in his belly, which began with a most violent attack. He was carried quickly into the palace, and when he had suffered continuously for 5 days from the pain in his belly, he died in the 54th year of his age and the 7th year of his reign. Note the striking parallels and similarities between the account in Josephus and that in Acts chapter 12. Yet note there are sufficient differences to show that there's been no dependence of one writer on the other, no collusion between them making up a fiction together. What is recorded in Acts 12 is what was well known as a historical event of the time. Herod, at the time at which the crowds were calling him a god, was suddenly, mysteriously, astonishingly struck down with some terrible disease in his belly, which led to his death. Now we say, well, okay, that's okay then. It did happen as Acts recounts. It's not a fiction. Okay, I accept your point now. That was history. That was a historical event. My friend, if you think that way, let me ask you, why do you now accept it? You accept it as true because a non-Christian Jewish historian says it. But you will not accept it because the Christian Bible writes about it. See, all the modern historians accept it. This is one that no one ever challenges because, well, Josephus says it. Even though we know Josephus was a liar, even we know that Josephus twisted and distorted history for his own purposes, we accept it because Josephus says it. But if Josephus wasn't there, well, then our scepticism and our cynicism would prejudice us against accepting what the New Testament says. Our rejection of the New Testament is indicative of our prejudice against it. Our cynicism. If Josephus says it's true, it's true. If the New Testament says it's true, it's to be doubted. What does that tell you about your attitude to the New Testament? You doubt it because the Lord struck him down, as it is described there? That is, you have a bias against supernatural world and language. You doubt it because it's a convenient moment for the Lord to strike him down? Well, you doubt it because of the explanation, worms eat him up, so it's not a 21st century medicine description. You doubt it because you've already made up your mind about God prior to the evidence and committed to doubt and cynicism as a way of life, committed to deny the evidence that lies before you. Remember, friends, the old saying that he who doubts everything knows nothing. The way of consistent, persistent doubting will never lead you to discover anything. Knowledge always requires trust. Socrates sounds superior because he knew one thing more than everybody else. He knew that he knew nothing. That made him one up on everybody. It's a good joke. It's a clever philosophical ploy. It gives you the arrogance of superiority. But it's a nonsense. For Socrates knew that if he drank the hemlock, he'd die. Socrates knew that other people around about him were ignorant. Socrates knew the principles of logic and argumentation. Socrates was a liar. He knew more than one thing. Cynicism is attractive. Skepticism is attractive because it allows you to be arrogant. It allows you to be superior. It allows you to look down on those poor believers around about you. But cynicism's arrogance is really ignorance. Because genuine cynicism can leave you to know absolutely nothing. Which is, of course, profound stupidity because we know lots. Yet that is where atheism will lead you over and over again, friends. The postmodernity about relativism and on all matters of language, the inability to say anything that is meaningful at all, is the end point of that kind of cynic atheism, that kind of scepticism. And Christians are influenced by this cancerous cynicism too. So we are embarrassed about angels or about God striking him down or about God talk at all. Embarrassed into silencing our own God talk. When we are in the community around about us, we won't mention God. We don't mention that we pray. We don't mention that we expect to see God's hand at work. We don't thank God for what he has done. We don't advance sin as the reason why the causes for the failings in our world around about us. We don't talk God talk to the outsiders because of the persecution of the outsiders of Christians here, because we've been endued by this same cancerous cynicism. While non-Christians, of course, are blinded to facts by their bias, by their prejudice of their own assumptions. Chapter 12 of Acts is asking the question, who is in charge here? You look at the world and the evidence of who is in charge is ambiguous. There is both death and deliverance. One apostle is put to death, one apostle is delivered. The one that puts to death, it looks like God's not in control, Herod's in control. The one who's delivered, it looks like Herod's not in control, God's in control. One story speaks of God's control, the other against it. But if you know about God and his plans and purposes, you would see the death of the apostle is the one that speaks of God being in control. For Christians, to see God in control is to see God putting into effect the things he has promised and predicted. But lest you are confused at all, The prophets and the apostles and the Lord himself all warned of power and persecution. The power of men to persecute the people of God and the power of man used to persecute the godly. We mustn't rely upon governments as Christians, or law, or courts, or popularity to protect us. We must expect that when the government is popular, it will ignore Christians, and when it is threatened, it will persecute Christians, or, like in Indonesia, it will allow the mobs to persecute Christians. And whenever the gospel makes advance, we must expect the backlash. So here on campus, or amongst some of our ethnic families, that is what we found. As the gospel has made progress in life, so the backlash of persecution has broken out. And we Christians must look to God in prayer for protection. God can protect us, but he's not promised that he always will. He can protect us in miraculous ways and also in very ordinary ways, but sometimes we just have to suffer for him and for his son's sake. A Greek friend was converted here on campus and told that he must never attend Bible study again. Over a period of time, both his parents were saved and become active members of the church. A Croatian friend was converted and came to church with us for some time until the Ustashi turned up and threatened to kneecap him if he ever turned up again. He hasn't been for a decade. A Lebanese friend became a Christian here and was taken out of the university, locked up in her bedroom, arrest for 2 to 3 years. We have lost contact with her. A Chinese friend became a Christian here on campus and their parents took them away from this university and away from Australia and sent them to Scotland to finish their university course there, where he became a leader of the Christian group at that university. A Jewish friend of mine became a Christian here on the campus and she was kicked out of home, only the next day to be provided with accommodation by one of her family friends, non-Jewish family friends, whose elderly parent had to be put into care and they needed someone to look after the house free of charge. You can never be sure whether it's going to be protection or persecution. You can never be sure which it's going to be in this world, but both are under the hands of the sovereign God. And in these lessons and illustrations, we have the powerful reminder of who is in control, so as to put a reminder to pride and punishment. Herod thought that he was in control. He was able to oppose God. He was able to accept the praise of men. But Herod was cut down as a striking warning to all people who would stand in the place of God. He had reasonable information to think that he was in control. He persecuted Christians without any difficulty, and he was growing in popularity and power as a result. There was no retaliation from God for his actions, but he was wrong. He didn't have the truth on his side. He didn't rule independently of God. It is God who rules over all. It is God who is in control. And you must know the plan and purposes of God to see how he is in control. For part of his sovereignty is to see his people persecuted, just as the essence of his plan was to see his son crucified. While we want Mr. Howard and Mr. Carr to take the heed of this warning, we must remember that we too are under God's power and control. We who are going to be the rulers of commerce and industry, we who are the rulers in our families and homes. So who do you think is in control here, God or yourself? If God, then give him the honour and remember Herod. If you think it's yourself, then be warned and remember Herod. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank and praise you for all things, and especially for your sovereignty. Help us to so understand your plans that we will see your hand at work in this world. Help us to continue to trust you and your sovereignty over us, that we would not live as if you do not exist. And we pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.